Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Like we've been doing every single day for months, and we'll continue to do, assuming we have an election in November of 2020. And you'll understand why I say that after you hear the next interview. We begin with the words of Colonel Vindman. Colonel Vindman gave some powerful testimony to the impeachment hearings in the fall of September, in the fall of 2019. And of course, the most memorable line, I think, is the one where he assures his father that he made the right decision by coming to America. And as I listened to Colonel Vindman, I was so proud. I thought, what a patriot. And then I saw, months later, he and his brother basically escorted out of the White House. And I thought, oh my God, maybe it wasn't such a good decision for him. Maybe it hasn't been such a good decision for the rest of us, given the fact that we have Donald Trump as president. But let's hear the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I'm looking at an article, and the article is at HuffPost, and it's entitled, COVID-19 is fast becoming a woman's economic crisis. And I'm thinking, why am I not surprised by this? We already know that women earn less than men on the dollar. We already know that when you're looking at a lot of the frontline workers, whether they're nurses or whether they're in a lot of the service industries, we know they either have lost their jobs or they're in hospital settings where they could actually lose their life. And I decided we have to talk about this. So joining us right now is Emily Peck. She is a senior reporter at Huffington Post who covers business, economics, and gender inequality. She also used to be a former Wall Street Journal editor and previously worked for the American Lawyer magazine. Wow. What a bio, Emily. So as two women talking about this, this is a story that should not shock anyone. But at the same time, when do we finally recognize that this has been a historic problem? And do you think that what we're now understanding from this pandemic, that it will be the impetus for us to begin to address so many of the myriad of issues that women face both in the workplace, in the home setting, and in the kind of economic equity they deserve?
Well, I mean, like so many other things during this pandemic, this virus has really exposed the vulnerabilities that women face and the cracks in the social safety net that we've always faced. So first, there was no paid family leave for the millions and millions of women who are home right now with children and no childcare to send them to, no schools to send them to. And these women are facing the heartbreaking choice of, you know, going without income, essentially. You know, they're actually not facing a choice. They can't earn income right now. And then on the flip side, we're seeing the industries where women make up the majority of the workforce getting hit really hard by pandemic closures. So restaurants, retail, these industries are seeing immense numbers of layoffs, and women are the ones, really everyone is losing jobs in this crisis. I'm not saying men aren't being hit hard by COVID, but it's really women who are bearing the brunt of these layoffs. The jobs numbers that came out last week were really striking. The first time ever women have seen double digit unemployment numbers at a higher number than men are facing. And right. Even in industries where women don't make up the majority of workers, they're making up the majority of the job losses because It is the lowest paying and the most vulnerable workers who are losing jobs at a faster rate. And sadly, that's women. Right. Women make up the majority of the lowest wage workers in this country. That's part of the reason there is a wage gap. And it's part of the reason they're suffering so much now.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. So I have a friend who will turn 100 in a couple weeks. And she was very lucky. She broke her pelvis, went into the hospital, and then went into a rehab place. But we got her out just before COVID really hit and started hitting places like nursing homes and rehabs and whatever. But I remember that as I was walking around the hallways, I think I may have seen one male who was working within the rehab facility. Okay. And it was the guy that was coming in, not working around the clock, to do some rehabilitation with a couple of the patients, but virtually everybody else, the people that were serving the food, the people that were basically caring for them, everyone else for the most part was basically female. And you look at this population, and once again, women have always been historically the caregivers. But when we imagine caregivers, we imagine taking care of their children, maybe taking care of their parents. But let's be honest here. They are the caregivers, period. Because when you look at the most vulnerable populations, like our elderly, it is women that are on the front lines. And as a consequence, not only are they caring for them, earning less, going home, caring for their family, now having their kids at home. I mean, it's kind of like we've heard of the sandwich generation. I mean, this is the club sandwich generation because there are just way too many layers and none of them are emotionally satisfying or financially satisfying.
Oh, absolutely. I think this has been absolutely a caregiving crisis in this country. Yes. I mean, women are, first of all, they make up the majority of the essential workers who are out there, the healthcare workers doing like this really scary, dangerous, and essential and necessary work right now in our hospitals and our nursing homes. And then also you have women around the country, like I said before, at home doing extra caregiving, you know, for their children, for their elderly parents, all of that. And you're seeing how there is no policy recognition of this double and triple burden that these women are facing. There's, you know, Congress has passed this very weak sick leave in the second stimulus act that leaves out 83% of the workforce. Like, what?
Wait. They have a sick leave policy that leaves out 83% of the workforce? What kind of joke is this? So just tell me, what were the parameters of that sick leave policy that they managed to do a carve out of the vast majority of people who should have access to this?
Yeah, so this was the second stimulus, the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act. This was in March.
Okay.
The House Democrats wanted to include like robust paid sick leave of 2 weeks if you're dealing with COVID, or 12 weeks if you're caring for someone else or you need to recover, you know, what you would think
you would need.
So they passed that in the House, but then it gets to the Senate, and under White House pressure and Senate Republican pressure, they carve out anyone who works at a company that employs more than 500 people. That's like almost half of all the companies.
Right, exactly.
And then they carve out, they say, if you have a company with 50 people or less, you can exempt yourself. So that carves out even more people. Then the Department of Labor, which is run by Justice Scalia's son, Eugene Scalia, they write rules around the new provisions and they weaken them even further. They carve out healthcare workers.
What?
Really?
Oh my God.
Yes.
Oh and my they God. Count
Yes, and they count as healthcare workers anyone, like a very broad brushstroke. So like anyone who works at a drugstore or like a janitor who works in a hospital counts as a healthcare worker and can't get sick leave under these provisions. So the bottom line, according to one analysis, is up to 83% of the workforce isn't even covered by these provisions. So I think there's been a real failure of policymakers to really address the caregiving crisis here. And that just exemplifies it.
Emily, I want this last minute of our conversation to be made into a freaking ad. I want everyone around, I don't care who it is. I don't care if you're in Kentucky or you're in Texas. I want people to hear what you just described. Because it is beyond immoral. It's irrational. But again, you know, you keep thinking, so what's your agenda? what's your point? You know, I mean, when you look at everyone that they carved out, it is, it's so unconscionable. It makes me shake. I mean, yeah. I'll be honest with you. I cover so much of this. I did not know this. And the reason why I want this to be made into an ad is that if there is anything that should outrage people, it is what you just described. Because it is so shocking to hear. And the way they sort of kept creating more and more and more of a carve out. I mean, what was left on the table was such a joke. You know, exactly. That it really is. And I want to just go through some of the numbers from your article, because I want people to know you're not making this up, that it's hurting women more than men. So you point out women make up 49% of the U.S. workforce, but held 55% of the jobs lost in April as businesses shuttered to prevent the spread of COVID-19. You then continue, take notes, everyone. The unemployment rate for women stands at an unprecedented rate of 15.5%, the first time ever that U.S. women have faced a double-digit unemployment rate. For Black and Hispanic women, it's worse. Remember this as you go into the voting booth. It's 16.4% for Blacks and 20.2% for Hispanic women. I just want people to hear this, you know, because in the end, these workers are probably more than essential. A lot of them have lost their jobs, but as you point out, they were essential in what? In retail. They were essential in what? In the restaurant industry. They were, even what you said, even in industries that weren't hard hit, they were probably the last in, the most expendable, at least from the perspective of the boss. And the consequences are just amazing. But what I found fascinating is, why do you suggest that this is the first time ever that U.S. women have faced a double-digit unemployment? Is it because women have historically been the sort of the last ones into the employment sector? So during the Great Depression, women weren't working outside the home. So even if there was huge numbers, you couldn't have, women have always been unemployed, you know what I mean? For the purposes of defining what employment is. And then when you look at some of the other periods, I mean, obviously the 2008 economic meltdown, I'm just kind of curious as to what explains why this seems to be such a tragedy compared to other times.
Well, I mean, if you go back to the Great Recession, people used to call it, forgive me for this term, a man session, because the job losses were really focused or really centered in male-dominated industries like construction, manufacturing. So those are the industries that got hit the hardest last time. So men did see a much higher unemployment rate. And meanwhile, in the intervening years since the Great Recession, women have been doing really well. They have been getting more jobs, especially in healthcare and retail. Those are like the fast-growing sectors.
Right.
But the problem is, in this COVID economic crisis, it's so unique and weird. It's like the places where women had been doing well are the places getting hardest hit with layoffs. The fastest growing sectors of the economy have been these sort of like low paying jobs in retail and healthcare. And they were the first to go, because this is what the, you know, what the COVID crisis is. It's just a shutdown of any company or industry that has, you know, that's dealing with the public to stop the spread.
And they can't work remote. I mean, let's be honest. You can't work remote. The retail job you were doing does not accommodate working remote.
Exactly.
The restaurant job you were doing, so the restaurant's got, is not working remote. So once again, you've got the other thing is that not only are they lower wages, but they're social jobs.
Think about this, everyone.
They're social jobs. They're people jobs. And anything that involves working with people is a job that had to shut.
You know, exactly.
If you're working with a computer, guess what? You're typing. You know, and you're working through the electrical and the internet system. But if you are doing something where you actually have to touch someone or assist someone or help someone, then guess what? Those are the jobs that were probably the greatest impact. So one of the other things I saw in your articles that you wrote, you started talking about the fact that if we do another stimulus of some kind, we have to include childcare. That has to be a component of that next wave. And that the childcare piece can't just be to address the issues of the pandemic, but that if we write a bill, it really should be also anticipatory. Because you not only want to address the pandemic problem, but you want to be prepared for life after the pandemic. And childcare is going to be absolutely even more crucial, because we will have learned a lot of lessons from this pandemic about what needs to happen in the childcare setting.
Yeah, I mean, childcare I think everyone in the country has learned what we, I'm sure we already knew, Arnie, which is that childcare is essential. We need this industry, these childcare providers, to be there so that people can go to work. Which people? Women. If there are no, if the childcare industry craters and it is in trouble right now, I think a lot of these childcare centers work on, operate on very thin margins. They have, you know, fewer kids coming, so they're not making money. They still have their expenses. They're not public, right? We don't have public childcare in this country. These, this is a private industry with a very public purpose, and it's really struggling right now. And there's been a lot of push to get more money to the childcare sector. And there was a little bit of money in the third stimulus bill, but most people think you're going to need billions more just to, so this industry, so these providers are there if we ever come out of this crisis. And then exactly like you said, longer term, there are proposals on the table to, you know, to do an even bigger cash infusion to make the industry itself more stable. I mean, the workers, and speaking of vulnerable women workers at the bottom of the ladder, childcare providers, the teachers in these centers, they make an average wage of $11 an hour, which is not a living wage in this country. So hopefully this crisis has drawn people's attention to this sector, and there will be some kind of long-term thinking from policymakers. But again, I'm not super hopeful right now, given, you know, who's running the country.
Okay, so let me, so I've been doing a lot of thinking about what if schools open in the fall? And this goes directly to childcare, everyone. I want you to pay attention. And that is that I don't think they're gonna operate the way they used to operate, where everybody, all the buses come in, all the kids pile out, they go to class, they all go back on the bus. And they, I think what's gonna happen is you're gonna have kids going on certain days, depending on the letter of the alphabet, or you might have half days. So you got a group of kids coming in the morning, then a group of kids leaving, they wash down the school, and then a group of kids come in again. Now, why am I saying that? Because if they're little tutties and they're under the age of like 10 years old at least, they're gonna need somewhere to go if they're on a half day schedule. And you know who's gonna need for them to have somewhere to go? The employers. Because if they're gonna employ their mothers and fathers, then they can't go home to an empty house. Let's be honest, school is actually also daycare. The reason why a lot of the business community always supported full day kindergarten, they didn't give a crap about 5-year-olds. What they cared about was that a lot of 5-year-olds will have their mothers would have to pick them up or their fathers at the halfway point. And therefore, if they were like the rest of their brothers and sisters, they could at least be in school full time. It made for a more stable workforce. And also the mothers didn't, or the fathers didn't have to pay for at least half of a day of daycare every day because their kid was on half time. Well, you know what? We better invest in daycare. Because what's going to happen with schools, especially elementary schools, is those kids are going to have to go somewhere because their parents are going to have to be back in the workforce. And this is now, this is such an economic reason as much as a child security reason.
Oh, absolutely. I think, and this is going to hit the lowest paid workers the hardest because, you know, companies are already, like companies that employ white collar workers are already saying, don't worry about ever coming back to the office. Twitter today said you can work from home forever if you need to. But like, yeah, a lot of other workers don't have that like wonderful option, right? And they need their childcare and their schools to work for them, to be there to support them. Otherwise, a lot of people are going to fall through the net and they're not going to have, it's really tragic. And I wonder, I'll be keeping an eye on like the gender wage gap and women's labor force participation rate for a long time after this to see what happens to it, because I think it's really, we're in a dangerous moment in a lot of ways.
So keep an eye on women's wages, because it's not just the women who work in daycare centers, but certainly the amount that we pay to people who take care of our children, who we entrust to not only teach our young children in childcare and in lower grades of elementary school, but also to take care of them, to make them feel good about themselves as a human being, to teach,
socialize,
relate to friends, care about other people and not be self-centered. You know, the values that we want kids to come out with, like loving their neighbors, they deserve to be paid a living wage so they can have families and raise their own kids.
You know, what's amazing, Emily, is that, so in 1991, I decided I was going to run for governor. And there was a woman in my state who had run for governor in 1910. Okay, that was 10 years before women had the right to vote. Her name was Marilla Ricker. Okay, so now remember, she's running for governor in 1910 in the state of New Hampshire. And you know what she's running on, one of her platforms in 1910? Equal pay for equal work. Women were earning 50 cents on the dollar back then. And Marilla Ricker, this unbelievable, she was a lawyer. She was the first woman admitted to the bar, I think at the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. She was the first woman admitted to the bar in New Hampshire. She was a hot ticket, I'm telling you. This was unbelievable. Everyone said that they were reading stuff about her and they're going, oh my God, Arnie, you were cloning Marilla and you didn't even know it. Because what was so shocking to me was that here I was, how many years later, 1991, you know, running for governor. And I too was running on equal pay for equal work. And we were up to two dimes and a penny more from Marilla Ricker. So it was like 71 cents on the dollar. But the other thing I remember running on was that I started in the New Hampshire legislature and I gave birth a week before the election. And I breastfed on the floor of the House and I breastfed in committee and I brought my daughter with me. And everyone said, did you get permission? I said, no. But here's the other kicker. Even if I had to get permission, I didn't give a crap because I had been on the waiting list for daycare from the time I found out I was pregnant. And I didn't get called for an available slot until she was almost 17 months old.
Oh my God.
So understand, I had been waiting for almost 20 months for an opening. But so even, I mean, that was the dilemma. And I was so glad that I got to serve in the legislature as this young, you know, breastfeeding mother, because I wasn't bringing her because I wanted to prove a point. I was, you know, bringing her because I had no choice. And if anybody wanted to role model the challenges of the lack of access to daycare or the cost of that daycare and the kind of choices that we're asking people to make. But guess what? That was 1984. We're talking 2020. And the story that you're telling now, where we're begging for a couple of pennies into, you know, into childcare, when it is absolutely essential. And what you don't know is that this morning on our New Hampshire Public Radio, they were talking about how to reopen daycares in New Hampshire. And everyone, I'm going to attach that interview to your interview on the radio, because I want people to be able to go to the Facebook page and hear that discussion with daycare, you know, employers and workers, as we're having this discussion now. It'll break your heart, because what they were saying is, so now in order to address the pandemic, we're going to need more teachers, not fewer teachers, but we're going to need more teachers with maybe less students, because we need to do more cleaning. We need to have smaller class sizes. We need to, so everything now is working against them, Emily, everything.
Yeah, absolutely. The costs of providing childcare are going up, and we're not seeing a concurrent infusion of cash to meet that need. And this is an essential industry that women especially need to survive this pandemic. And yeah, and we're not seeing enough attention paid to it, I think. So I'm glad you're paying attention.
Well, it's tough being a girl. Because you can't, let's be honest, because you can't ignore it. And so before I let you go, so on my Facebook page the other day, I woke up and I said, what if just for like 20 years, every male leader was replaced by a female? Just for 20, let's just have an experiment, you know? And some guy wrote, oh, I don't care about the gender. I care about the quality of the candidate. I said, well, I like quality, but I like breasts too. You know, it's like, I'm just thinking that your experience, my experience, it's not that I notice, it's that I've lived it. And it's not that I'm better than a male, but I have a different life experience than them. And so the pressures are different. The choices are different. And it's not like it's a better choice, it's just that's what it is. But the problem is we represent more than probably 50% of the population. We represent 50% of the workforce, if not more, where, you know, we outlive the men, and yet for whatever reason, we're still at the back of the bus. And that's not good for society. It's not good for stability. And frankly, I'm not sure we can succeed until we address it. So I am glad you wrote your piece. COVID-19 is fast becoming a woman's economic crisis. I hope that they remember that when they write the next stimulus bill. Because I think we need to be the lead sentence. Emily?
There's a new proposal out today. They're trying again on paid sick leave and paid family leave, the House Democrats. So stay tuned, see what happens for that.
We'll get you back. We'll get to that, I promise. And you want to say something real quick?
In addition to continuing to raise the issues of equal pay and the access to daycare, I think that the mindset of males still needs to change in almost as big a way as the pay inequity issue. The idea that you could have people running for president of the United States now, where some people may or may not have said that a woman can't be elected president or can't even be nominated for president of the United States, whether that altercation actually happened or not, it's mind-boggling that there are still people who think that and who take that into consideration. And so there's a whole mental change that needs to happen in addition to the economic changes.
Well, let me say something. The best way to change those opinions is to elect a woman. And once you elect a woman, they get used to it. Let me just tell you, that was always my theory. Make me governor. Oh, but you're a girl. It's not a problem. You'll get used to it. That's what I used to say. Anyway, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. Thanks so much.
All right, take care. Ciao. Bye-bye. Emily Peck writes for Huffington Post. Her piece was about COVID-19, fast becoming a woman's economic crisis. Stick around. We'll be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Factories and power plants often release a lot of carbon pollution. And without a government tax on that pollution, there's not always a clear financial incentive for companies to reduce their emissions. Itasha Cave is co-founder of Opus 12. The California startup has developed a technology she says could motivate companies to invest in capturing their CO2 emissions.
To me, it just seemed like an elegant solution to provide a revenue stream for CO2 instead of throwing it away.
The company's technology breaks down carbon dioxide in water, then combines them to create other molecules. Those molecules can then be used to make materials such as alternative fuels or plastics. It's basically a way to recycle CO2 that would otherwise end up in the atmosphere.
One product, for example, is jet fuel. And you can imagine using that jet fuel in commercial flights. Another product we make is polycarbonate polymer. The lenses in most sunglasses and eyeglasses are made from that now. We can make that from CO2.
Opus 12 has already built a small version of its technology. The company still needs to build bigger units and prove it's commercially viable. But at scale, Cave says this technology could make it profitable for companies to capture their harmful emissions. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is Part 2 of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is the Wednesday edition. So I read an article at Voting Booth, and it's entitled, What Happens If Bush-Gore Result Happens Again with Trump-Biden? And I went, oh, God, I remember that in Florida, with the hanging chads. Oh, my God. But this is... that's a walk in the park, what happened with Bush Gore. And then I learned about a May 4th teleconference. And before I bring in my guest, I just want to read a sentence from his article because it was shocking. And you write, Steve Rosenfeld, never before in recent history have the nation's top constitutional and election scholars convened 6 months ahead of a presidential election to ward off what they fear could be a constitutional meltdown if an incumbent president and his most strident partisan allies seek to disrupt or disregard counting votes and the transfer of presidential power. Holy crap. The problem is, Steve, welcome to the program, first of all. And
thank
I just need to let you know, we actually sort of touched a little bit on this on our Monday discussion. because we were talking about mail-in voting and we were talking about Wisconsin and we were talking about the integrity of the election. And I just said, if it isn't an overwhelming result for one side or the other, he ain't gonna leave. He's gonna contest. And then I found out, well, you know, they actually had a teleconference about this on May 4th. And I'm thinking, wow, I wish I had been there. So let me welcome you to the program and tell my audience a little bit about this decision to pull together all these sort of great sort of theoretical and constitutional minds and election law minds. Who pulled it together? And what was sort of the sort of essence of the conversation? Because I think they gave sort of three possible scenarios or a couple of scenarios out there, trying to figure out what do we have in place that would give us some guidance on how to respond.
Okay, so there is a small community, probably dozens, four or five, you know, maybe 175 lawyers who are academic professors, and they also are specialists in election law as it follows after election day disputes around the country, who basically have, they study election law and constitutional law and where the process works and doesn't work and breaks down or doesn't break down. And one of them, who is at the Ohio State University, he runs the election law department of their law school, his name is Ned Foley. He is one of the authorities on presidential election disputes. And that means he has done all the research going back to the 19th century of what happens when people fight that they more to, it happened in 1876. Two candidates, Samuel Tilden, Rutherford B. Hayes, they both claimed to win. They were hyper-partisan. It went to Congress, and it wasn't settled with the Electoral College. It wasn't settled before the Congress. It lasted until 2 days before the inauguration.
Yeah.
Where the current president at the time, Ulysses Grant, thought that he was going to have to declare martial law to keep these two factions from colliding on the streets of Washington when one of them, Samuel Tilden, pulled out for reasons that have a lot to do with what became the end of Reconstruction and the imposition of all of that, you know, undoing of the Civil War in the South. So what these folks have been doing, what Ned Foley, who put this together, did was he tried to look at what are the scenarios that could lead to the same legal arguments being presented by Republicans and Democrats, who to basically send competing slates of electors from the same state, presidential electors, saying, no, we're voting for Trump. No, we're voting for Biden. And basically jam up the process so that it basically goes into this unprecedented territory before Congress. And the scenarios are frightening. They are frighteningly familiar with the stuff we're hearing about with all the noise and running elections in this pandemic right now. And so we can talk about that. Then we can talk about when you get to Congress, what you have is an absence of rules that are agreed upon. So it moves from like following the law or principles to who is the biggest bully, who's the biggest intimidator, who can muscle something through. And the only thing that's out there besides the Constitution itself is this law from 1887.
Yeah, exactly.
That is ambiguous. And the best scholars of our day said that the U.S. Supreme Court didn't even understand or use right when they did Bush v. Gore. So this is really crazy stuff, because what happens here is voting by mail is not fast and it is not easy.
Right.
And it's going to create these giant vacuums where Trump is going to come in and fill that void with all the crazy stuff that we have been hearing already.
Yeah. So so as I'm looking at, they gave three nightmarish scenarios. That's really what they did. And as I'm reading the scenarios, I'm going, hasn't that happened already? Or isn't it very sure? So, I keep thinking about Wisconsin And of course, what we saw with Wisconsin was they went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, then they went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then the question was, are we going to vote in person? What about the absentee ballots? Yada, yada, yada. Then the Supreme Court made a decision about absentee ballots. It had never been the way the Wisconsin absentee ballots had been interpreted. So there was, I mean, everything was changing. But what was so interesting about these three nightmarish scenarios is that not only was everything changing, not only were there delays, but everything was changing at the last minute. And when everything changes at the last minute, everybody says, is it credible? Can we trust it? Because we think that someone is sort of manipulating or massaging some kind of a result in order, some kind of law to get a result. And I think that was the thing that I took away from is, at not only is there going to be chaos going in, not only do we see that there's the potential for so many things to fail, but if we ask someone to come in at the last minute to establish what the interpretation is or what the rules will be, who the frick's going to trust it?
Well, this is kind of what Trump is doing right now with attacking voting by mail. He's laying the foundation to not trust any outcome, however legitimate it may be. But let's talk about these scenarios. Let's talk about we've seen so far. Okay, so the primaries more or less stopped after Michigan in mid-March, and they only resumed first in Wisconsin and then in Ohio on April 28th.
Right.
And what you saw there in those two elections and were basically in Wisconsin, 140,000 people who voted by mail-in ballots didn't get their ballots in on time or they were disqualified. That was 6% of the total vote there for people who thought they were voting honestly and it didn't get counted. In Ohio, by the way, where the final vote counting is, it's almost 2 weeks now since that election. As of yesterday, they still have not accounted for 250,000 ballots, 20,000 by mail and 40,000, 200,000 by mail and another 45,000 by people who showed up in person and were given what's called provisional ballots, which have to be validated. So we're talking about these super high volumes of ballots that are in play and they're hanging out there somewhere in space. They haven't landed yet. So what happens here? What are these scenarios? So they in Michigan, the scenario was that it's taking a really long time to count these ballots. And as they start getting counted, Trump is ahead initially on election night, and then it starts moving to Biden. And then he starts making all this noise that we should stop the counting because it's good enough. Like he said in Florida when Rick Scott was running in the 2018. Right. None of this is made up out of thin air. This is all precedent. And then the Republican legislator says, you know what? We don't trust that the Democrats are counting these ballots or running the process in the state capitol. We're going to appoint our own electoral college slate. And so basically they are disregarding a legal process, the prior legal the disregarding the popular vote. Now the variety of that, so what happens there is you get Democrats then suing, you have all these, you know, conflicting lawsuits between state courts and federal courts, but the Democrats then say, hey, you can't break the rules. You got, and then they send their slate of electors. So you get Republicans with one and Democrats with another. Now, if you get the opposite of that in Pennsylvania, where, again, here's where this example comes in. Thousands of people who live around Philadelphia don't get their absentee ballots in the mail. They don't get them on time. So what happens? Our friends in the voting rights community do what they do, which is they go and sue. And they sue at the state Supreme Court, which, by the way, is friendly for voting rights. It's the only state Supreme Court in the country that overturned the Republican gerrymander, was the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So what do? They extend voting for a couple more days past election day so people can get their ballots in. Well, now the Republicans say, hey, you're changing the rules that are pre-existing. And there too, it's a Republican legislature. So they say, not only are we going into court, we're gonna go back to the old rules as they were pre-established, which is, by the way, what the federal courts these days tend to support because they're conservative. And they say, well, we're using that and becomes an excuse for them to send a Republican slate of presidential electors to Washington, to Congress. And then, so, you know, it starts with people trying to defend the right to vote, but people not receiving ballots, and it ends up with a sympathetic court helping them, and then the Republicans turning that upside down and saying, no, you can't change the rules, we're going into federal court, and in the meantime, we're going to use the Democrats breaking the rules to send our own slate of electors. And so those are the, and it's the same logic. You can't change the rules, except you just happen to be bending it around facts that fit your candidate in different ways. So what happened was, these law professors were talking about, you know, how realistic is this? And then they were saying, what do you do next around all this? And it's very realistic.
Ken?
Didn't it happen in Wisconsin, Steve? Certainly the extra days for the absentee ballots, you hadn't gotten the absentee ballots day of election. So how could you fill them out and turn them in?
But they didn't allow them. They didn't allow that. And what the court said was they had to be postmarked on election day.
The court said, too bad, you can't extend the time.
Right.
What the court said in Wisconsin was they had to be postmarked by election day, but they could arrive up to a week later. And that allowed 130 or 35,000 more votes to be counted. But there still were 140,000 other votes that didn't get counted because they came in too late. So this is the landscape.
Right. So what was an amazing teleconference. Happens on May 4th. They go through these three scenarios, all of which are, not only are they highly plausible, but we've seen a variation on their theme already happening. So it's not like they're making stuff up out of whole cloth. They're actually making stuff up that you could say, didn't this happen here? Didn't this happen there? You know, but now we're talking about a highly charged landscape where you've got 50 states, of which maybe a dozen of them could have a variation on the theme that you've just described. So what was the upshot for them? Were they holding this for group therapy, this teleconference? Were they holding it to offer recommendations in anticipation? Were they asking, sending something to Congress or sending something to the states? What did they see as the raison d'être for doing this conference in a way of not just scaring each other, but making sure that people said, so let's give ourselves some guidance now. I don't know who's going to follow that guidance, but if nothing else, to sort of at least warn people this could happen. How are you prepared to address it?
Well, that's exactly what the purpose of this was to try to identify if there are standards or lines in the sand that the legal community, which involves both, you know, liberal and conservative, you know, scholars, can agree to. And like, for example, should there be agreement that state legislatures can't either ignore popular votes or act unilaterally? And what you started getting was you started hearing the conservative lawyers saying no.
Uh-huh.
This was stunning to me. So what you got was you had conservative lawyers. This one fellow was saying, when he was talking about Pennsylvania, he was saying, well, you know, if you liberals think it's great that you're extending voting, guess what? You know, the date of voting past election day because to help people didn't get absentee ballots, guess what? We conservatives think you're changing the rules in the middle of the game. That gives us a perfect reason to run to the federal courts, including the Supreme Court, which basically has said the legislatures have the final say, and therefore this final say, you have to follow the rules that they have adopted, and which included weakening the governor of Wisconsin's ability to shut down the election.
Right.
You know, so that was a legislative move. So the thing is, what this guy was saying was, you're actually helping us. You know, you voting rights people are actually helping us make the case where we can act unilaterally in that case, which is stunning to me, because what you're talking about here is people who are basically, they're not willing to agree. You had another guy say, well, you know, I don't know that I necessarily trust the official results.
Okay, so where is he going to go? Under what rock? Is he going to find the result he trusts? I mean, come on.
Well, no, but I mean, this is the thing. So what happens here is, you know, you go into conspiracy theory land where you can't prove something and you can't disprove something. Right. But and this is the craziness we're hearing from Trump right now. And these are scholars. So, and then you get this thing where people are saying, well, maybe it's a good idea for it to go before Congress, because then there'll be a big public debate and people will pay attention. I'm thinking, okay, let's think about this. First of all,
You get a debate in the House with one result.
No.
Debate in the Senate with another result, and you're back in the same sort of situation you were before.
You skipped an important step. Your eyes will roll even more from this. A joint session of Congress. Guess who is the presiding officer who decides to allow Pence. What questions? Right, Pence, the vice. Somebody on the ticket.
Right.
And so,
talk about a conflict of interest. You know, yes. The appearance of impropriety. Oh, it sounds just like everything Trump would love.
Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening here is, you end up, election day is, November 3rd. The Electoral College is supposed to meet five weeks after that. So right now we've got in Ohio, April 28th election with 23% voter turnout, and they still haven't finished counting ballots, and they still haven't accounted for 250,000 ballots. So what happens when the turnout is 2 to 3 times that? How long is this going to take? And then the question becomes, if you get all this craziness, I don't trust this, I don't trust that. So then what ends up happening is it moves to Congress. And you're saying, what were these scholars looking for? They're looking for, where can you agree that there are principles or lines that we should not cross? Well, they couldn't agree on it. So then what ends up happening is it moves to Congress, and you have this law, this Electoral Count Act of 1887. So after the 1876 presidential election was deadlocked, and the fight lasted until 2 days before the inauguration. It took them 14 years, because they started debating this before, 12 or 14 years, to come up with, some piece of, some legislation to not have this happen again. It is the most, it is this opaque, long, difficult, unclear,
it doesn't offer guidance, is what you're basically telling me. It's obtuse. Yeah. It doesn't.
And the people who are the most current scholars of it, who have done the most work on it, they say that nobody in Congress understands it, first of all, or even knows about it. Then they say the Supreme Court misapplied it in Bush v. Gore. And the only thing in it that might offer a little bit of something is it happens to say that governors have the final say over legislators, but this has never been tested. So this is more craziness, because, okay, so you have these Republican majority, legislatures in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, Florida, and then in some of those states in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, you have Democratic governors. So it's like a whole nother level of what are we gonna fight over here? And then there's no clear, easy answer. So what ends up happening here, and this is where the scholars got really scared, was they were saying stuff like this. They were saying, we're scholars and we look for institutional norms. They use the word norms all the time. We look for things, shared assumptions that we can agree to regardless of outcome. But there are not shared norms here. They're not a shared sense of values undergirding the rules.
Right.
So this is where they were talking about, they use language like this. They say, they call it politics and not law. So what does that mean? That means that you are basically, it's like law of the jungle. So it's whoever can be the biggest bully, it's might makes right. And this is where this is where things could be headed. We look at Trump, we look at the RNC, and we look at they just doubled their voting rights litigation budget from $10 to $20 million to fight this in state by state. I mean these guys are killers. They will do anything to stay in power. And all I'm saying here is these scholars, they could not really point to too many rails to hold on to that people share, because what's underneath them is they don't share the values, the assumptions, the principles.
So I'm telling you, I read your piece, Steve, and it was chilling. It was like, I mean, I keep saying, I had this conversation with my 99-year-old friend who says she's ready to go, but she's not going to go until the day after the election. All right, that was her promise. I'll die the day after. And I said to her, Mary Lou, here's the problem. It may not be resolved by then. And I've been saying that over and over again. And then I read your piece. And I'm like, I called her up and I said, you got to wait at least a couple of months. Because as I'm reading this, it was, I mean, it is a prescription for chaos. It's a prescription for civil war. And unless, I'm going to go back to what I said the other day, Ken, on the air, the vote has to be so not close. It right. cannot be close. And the problem right now is there has been so much effective work on voter suppression. The problem is you've got a pandemic. The problem is you've got different interpretations of, you know, for the purposes of Texas, fear of getting COVID-19 is not a disability for an absentee ballot. In the state of New Hampshire, fear of getting COVID-19 is a disability for the purposes of getting an absentee ballot. In the state of Vermont, the governor, who's a Republican, and the Democratic Secretary of State are trying to figure out when to pull the trigger on mail-in voting, and the governor says, oh, let's wait. And the Secretary of State is going, if we wait, we won't be able to do it, because I need time to prepare for mail-in voting. So you look at all the chaos that's happening now.
Right.
The anticipation and the interesting divergent interpretations now. And this wasn't even one of the scenarios in your piece at Voting Booth. And that's what's so shocking to me is that I'm looking at this and going, honey bun, I can throw in at least four or five more things into this mix. And I don't see how the hell we get anything close to a resolution unless it's 60-40.
And can right. I just add one other part of it, which is really scary to me, and that is, you know, in your piece, Steve, you talk about how the sitting president, who was Grant at that time, was thinking about bringing in martial law in order to resolve the dispute,
this is us, Grant.
Hopefully in an unbiased way, and now the sitting president is also on the ballot. Grant wasn't. And the sitting president has a conflict of interest to use his martial law, his military power, to hold on to the presidency. And that is just scary as heck. I've been thinking about that for 4 years, and now it's looking like it's a realistic problem.
Well, you know, I just want your listeners to understand that, you know, we're not sitting around in rooms, you know, making this stuff up out of fantasy and fear and paranoia. Everything we're talking about here is, you know, was coming from the top constitutional lawyers and law professors in this country. And by the way, that includes the use of terms like civil war. You know, it's not just from Arnie saying it. You know, these are people who are the top constitutional scholars who are saying this stuff. Okay. And everything else that you're talking about, Arnie, I mean, this is stuff I mostly try to cover, about the complexities that are facing us with executing, you know, voting by mail in states that haven't had it. There are a thousand ways that those can just sort of create little micro fuses that lead to bigger blow-ups. And here we are.
And I want to remind everyone that not only do we have the idea of maybe we should do vote by mail, but now we have a war in the United States Postal Service being led by Donald Trump. So again, one of the things that we're sort of assuming is that you have a postal service that's not bankrupt, where they're still actually providing mail service. And so you're looking, I mean, almost every way you look at this story, there's something ready to blow up. And that's what I thought, that's why I had a tough time, I'll be honest with you, Stephen, I had a tough time reading it. Because I was just so frightened by what I read, because now I knew that I wasn't crazy and wasn't alone. So I think that's important. Anyway, Steve Rosenfeld, thank you so much for writing. Thank you for having a place called Voting Booth. We need to get back to you on a regular basis, because I want people to think about this. And if nothing else, it's an incredible motivator to make sure you're there in November to exercise the franchise, because every vote is going to count, and you're definitely going to want to make sure it's not close. Because close is a prescription for failure. The title of his piece, What Happens If Bush-Gore Result Happens Again with Trump-Biden. Steve Rosenfeld, thank you so much.
Thank you, Arnie. Appreciate it. Thank you, Ken.
All right. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll chat tomorrow. Ciao. Now I'm out. Oh, I'm in control. Now I'm out. Oh, I'm in control.
But I wonder how is time gonna change her?